session number 23827, Reel 2.
Then we went to Torquay, which was to an ITW now, 13 ITW. There were three ITWs in Torquay. One wore, the other two wore white belts, but we didn't. We wore a grey belt, and we're very proud of the fact we didn't have to blanker our belts like they did.
Right. I'll stop you just there.
And it was in the Grand Hotel in Torquay.
I'll stop you just there. John Street, end of Reel 1. John Street, Reel 2. So, Grand Hotel, Torquay.
Yes, we went to the Grand Hotel, and that was quite an interesting time, because we worked hard mentally, and again, things happen, you remember afterwards. I don't know if you know, but the RAF of today, the RAF regiment, have got what they call a dumb drill team, where they go out and they go through a great load of exercises without any words of command. They're shouted at to start, and they do all these things on their own. And if you read the books, you'll find a lot of people in 1944, I invented this. In 1950, I invented this. But that was invented in 1941 because our instructor was the laziest bloke I'd ever come across. And I don't know his name, I can't remember it, I don't suppose I should say it if I did. But he used to march us off to this railway station, which had a big yard, but nothing in it, because the war was on, and I don't suppose there was much on the railway trains. But the little canteen or cafe, railway cafe, was still open. I think they used to sell rock cakes and cups of tea. And he would go and sit in there, but having instructed us what to do. And of course, it was all done by, you know, 10 paces do this. And we used to do that day in and day out when we weren't in the classroom. And the other funny thing, of course, was every now and again they'd have an invasion exercise. And the Home Guard and the local army units and all that, and the ARP people and the hospitals would get all geared up for the Germans to flood up the sands of Torquay. But the air crew, we were marched north. As soon as it started, we'd have to march north. Well, as you can imagine, sometimes they forgot about us, and it was, you know, kind of 24 miles later when they suddenly found us. And,
you were still marching north?
Just still marching north. We were told to march north, so we marched north. But there were a lot of us. Some of I think that I got to the stage now and I realised there were two sorts of people. Were those green who just come straight into the Air Force and gone straight to the IW, and it had been me who'd done a bit of, you know, this, and I knew a few tricks of the trade. And I remember myself and a fellow called Kerry Drew. We used to always get in the back of the queue, and we'd walk about 2 miles outside of Torquay, and there was a place you could nip off into the edge, and his father was a vet, and he had a contact farmer there, and we used to go and sleep in his, we used to go and stay in his, one of his barns, until we heard the noise of him coming back, and tack ourselves on the back again.
It sounds all quite casual.
It was. I thought it was very casual. When I look back, I thought it was obviously good training, because we were the finest Air Force in the world eventually.
But compared with what I hear about the army and the drill and the march, well, I don't know.
We did a lot of drill. I remember when we were at Henlow that, I can remember stupid things. I can remember, we'd had a night, in fact, of a bombing, and but they got us up in the morning, and instead of going to clear up the bombing that we thought we were going to, this bloke, this flight sergeant, took us to a coal yard, a coal store on the camp, and we had to move all this coal from one place to another, sweep this place absolutely clear with spray and water, get all the whitewash it, and pull all this coal back again. And then about 4 nights later, 5 days later, we say 4 or 5 days later, I remember moving all this corn again, sweeping up and spreading and painting it with black tar, because somebody realised that a white thing was visible from the air. And you think, well, is there anybody running this show? You know, because you all thought you were better than they did. But I got a feeling that I suppose it was the RAF's way of disciplining you, but they weren't following the army way.
How strict were they on inspections and things?
Oh,
like
they were
that?
They were quite. Yes, I mean, if you were clever, you had your inspection stuff, which you, the pair of boots you'd half itched, you know, when you were sent down the stores to do, because you used to steal an awful lot. I was so dishonest from the time I joined the Air Force. and you'd lay it all out on the bed, and you had to emery cloth your, you had to blacken the, you know, polish the boots, soles of your boots, and then you had to polish the bleakers, they had to be emeryed, the bleakers, and they kind of caution you, because your shaving brush was wet. Well, you'd only shaved half an hour before, and you laid your kit out, and you weren't allowed, I think you were allowed one photograph inside the inside your locker door. It had to be, to begin with, it had to be a family member or a girlfriend. I always remember that there were a lot of, what do they call it? There were a lot of people that didn't take kindly to discipline, but they managed to get through. I think the Air Force realised that a man who bucked discipline was as good as a man who didn't. And I remember there was a big row once where this fellow stuck a picture of, and a famous picture it was, I think, if I remember rightly, of Betty Grable looking over his shoulders with her kind of extra long legs. and like this, and he said, "I'm going to take that down." And I said, "Well, it's just my sister." And I always remember this big argument whether there was a black sister or not. It was obviously Betty Grable, you know. There's silly things like that I remember, but nothing ever happened. The bloke might get, he might get picked on for a couple of days, and then they find somebody else to pick on. I think the Air Force always went in for this, picking on one person, and they did this right the way through into the 50s. Pick one person and beat him to death, and that's to show the other people what's doing. But the fellow that was beaten to death didn't necessarily lose on it.
Did anyone get into real trouble or drop out?
Oh yes, we had a lot. We did have dropouts.
Why would that be?
Well, people who perhaps mainly couldn't cope educationally, or they were too much of a rebel. I think if you were too much of a rebel, you would, because you had to work as a team. We had a lot of team exercises. We would go out and we'd be told that a lot of them were based on, I suppose, civil defence things. They hadn't quite got into these peculiar ones they got now, where you've got two planks and you've got to get across a river, and they were straightforward ones. You know, you'd have to, they'd say, "Oh, that house is unsafe," and you'd have to work out so well, propping it up and things like that, and you worked as a team, because of course, unless you were a fighter pilot, you flew as a team, I suppose. And I think the training was quite good. I think it was better than the American type. This I never went to America, but I heard stories, of course, of, you know, that for the first while at flying school, you wore your goggles around your neck. What are you? I am a dodo. Why are you a dodo? A dodo cannot fly. I cannot fly, therefore I am a dodo. Sir, you know, and you were saying this to a bloke in the next course. We never had that sort of thing. Never had that stupid sort of thing. It was funny in a way. It's like everyone knew that it was the blunt of it, It was hard. I mean, and you would, something would happen, and you'd perhaps be told to be outside the stores at 2 o'clock, and you get there, and of course you find that the stores had two outsides, one that way and that one. You'd be outside the wrong one. And I think you knew in the end this was done purposely, and you get shouted at and yelled at, and right, 6 o'clock tonight, an extra hour is drill, you know, that sort of thing.
Did
people
resent that? Did you resent it?
I think if you resented it and you fail out, I think that's what they wanted. I think there was an easy way of getting rid of people they considered. I suppose they were... I think now they got psychiatrists and sort of people like that. Not that it's any better, I don't think, sometimes, because I remember once I was involved in that sort of thing, and the young girl that was supposed to be, well, she was a, had a lot of letters after her name, she made a bigger hash of it than what I did before I got her, but because... I mean, you know, you miss out down the line about it somehow. But the Air Force, I think, had decided that this was a way that discipline, being shouted at, was a good thing. But it was all aiming for this teamwork, I think.
Right. What were the other chaps like there? I mean, you've got your own particular background. Were they?
Oh, they were all different. I ended up with my three best mates who I stayed with for quite a while. One was very, very well off. His father was the managing director of a very, very internationally known firm, and his mother and father were divorced, but her mother had gone her way, and she was the owner manager of a big hotel chain. He was gone to public school and all sorts of things, but we were great mates. And he got killed, unfortunately, during the war. But his family, his brother, who was a major then, followed his mother, and he had a big holiday camp on the south coast. I've met him a couple of times.
What was his name?
Am I allowed to say that,
yes,
really?
Yeah, it's not.
Francis. The Francises. I don't know what the mother's name was, but I don't think it was Francis, but the father was, I suppose, mm-hmm. Francis. Mm-hmm. They had a hotel in Newquay, the Hotel Bristol, which we stayed in two or three times, and it was been taken over by a girls' school. And when we stayed there, the headmistress of the school wouldn't let us stay there, so we never slept there. We had to sleep down the road at another hotel. The other fellow was, quite well educated, and I don't know what it was all over England, but certainly down in the southern part of England, you didn't, although you went to college to become a vet, most of your training was done on the job. And this fellow eventually... became a vet, and of course that was a lot higher than my aspirations to be a vet. I mean, and I was friends with them of course the first one I say got killed, but the other one I was friends with him until he died a few years ago, and I still speak to his wife because I met her, of course, when she was his girlfriend. That's my two best friends on the thing. And then I got separated from them, and I picked another fellow up, and he again had been to a public school, and we got on, we were great mates until we separated again. But there were some that you kind of looked at and you never cottoned on to for one way or another, and it was both ends of the scale. I remember there was one fellow that was always trying to sell insurance to us. He had an insurance round, it appeared, and his wife was now taking it on. And he used to kind of go around, always on about taking out insurance, because we never knew what insurance was in those days. What's insurance?
Yeah. You were in quite risky occupations too, weren't you, really?
Yeah. But there were other boys. I mean, there's another... in fact, I found it the other day, and I've lost it again, but I was going to send it off to one of these things and ask if anybody recognised the photograph. It was myself and the fellow. It said on the back of the thing at Whitley Bay, and he was a miner, I didn't see him for years until about 1944, I suppose. I ran into him again, and he was like me, an officer of aircrew, and he said, "I was lucky," he said. "I could have been sent down the mines." He was a miner, you know. He'd kind of come into the Air Force, and then, of course, about 1944, they started this Bevan boy thing, didn't they? They sent them down the mines. I could have been sent down the mines, he said. And I thought, yeah. But you were down the mines. Yeah.
So the RAF obviously selected people on ability. They weren't put off.
As long as you had something you could work on. I think the RAF realised they had to train us. I mean, people aren't don't learn to fly at school. I was one of the few people that done any knew anything about navigation. I mean, as soon as the bloke started to talk about radius of action, I knew what he meant, but he had to explain to the others what he meant by radius of action or point of no return and things like that.
So at 13 ITW, what sort of training were you doing there? Were you doing navigation?
Yeah, you did navigation, a bit of RAF admin, you know, the outer, you know, the things were ran in history of the RAF. But mainly maths and aircraft recognition, of course. Oh, and Morse, because we did Morse in those days, and the navigators were expected to get up to 12 words a minute. So you did have a lot of Morse.
How easy was that for you?
I was quite good at Morse, actually. I could hear then. In fact, I kept that up until a few years ago. I used to tune my radio in and pick up. I think I was working Porter's Head. I wasn't working them. They were just sending the Morse out, and they used to send it, say, 8 words a minute, and then put the speed up to 10 to 12. And I reckon I could receive it about 15 to 18 words a minute. I couldn't send, obviously, I wasn't getting the practice in. And I used a side key in the RAF. I was one of the few people that used a side key. And of course, I couldn't ever get a side key. And as I got older, I found my mind didn't control that bit. But I did Morse for a long time. I enjoyed Morse.
So you were doing Morse, you were doing all your navigation.
Yeah, and of course, you do a bit of guns. Because you would be a navigator, of course. No, I wasn't a navigator, I was an observer. Mm-hmm. An observer was from the First World War, of course. You could be a navigator, or you could be just a wireless operator, or you could be a gunner. I think wireless operating got too technical. Well, there were very few navigators who were wireless operators properly. We had this ability to take more. But I don't think, if you were a good navigator, if you were good in navigation and you could only do five or six words a minute, I don't think they would kick you out because it was one of those things they taught you to give you a way of assessing you, I suppose. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a secondary importance then. Yeah. So how long were you at Torquay then?
They're only about 6 or 8 week courses, most of these.
And did you have to, you had to pass, did you, to carry on?
Well, then, for some unknown reason, and I never ever found out why, that I got sent off to Booker, which was a tiger moth station, and I learned to fly a tiger moth.
Oh, right. So they decided to teach you to fly, didn't they?
Yeah, they teach you to fly. And now, somebody did tell me afterwards that this was, again, something that the RAF were trying to do, and then suddenly decided not to do it. That they were going to have pilots who were navigators and navigators that were pilots, but they stopped it. They didn't do it. I don't know why these things were thought up and thing. So at the end of that training, I was reassessed again, and I suppose I went to Canada then.
Okay,
I went to Canada then from this flying training course at Booker.
Yeah, whereabouts in Canada?
I went to a place called Calgary. Uh-huh. But I only went there to be assessed. And I was not chosen to continue flying as a pilot. And I was sent off to the eastern side of Canada. In March 1942, in fact, I started my NAV training at an AOS, Air Observer School, in Chatham, New Brunswick.
Oh, right. Sorry, AOS.
AOS, yeah. Mm-hmm. Air Observer School.
Yeah. Sorry, that's where?
It's Chatham, New Brunswick.
Sorry, Chatham.
Yeah.
So what was that like?
That was very interesting, because we were now down to the nitty-gritty that any discipline was a different sort of discipline. And it was also a bit stricter. There were people taken off the course because they were late at briefings too often. The discipline seemed to be aimed at things that really mattered rather than your ability to move coal from A to B. And of course, there were the failures of people who failed the exams, because we had exams on the past month.
So and what things will they be teaching you in this navigator training? Separate subjects? Or?
Well,
you've got a book there.
Well, it's a mid-long book. You did navigation, plotting, that was the actual plotting on the maps. You did maps in charts, and then all the projections, and, you know, the fact if you're around the Arctic, you use polar projections, and, you know, the different ways that maps are made. Well, they're interesting maps, you know. I've often thought it was rather funny that the map I used all my life as a flyer was invented by a man called Mercator, who invented it when he thought the Earth, when the rest of the world thought the Earth was flat. Well, it's marvellous, that. And the same with a bloke called Fourier, who developed a system of magnetism that wasn't used from 1100 up until 1960, when the V-Force found it was a useful formula to use. Maps in charts, magnetism in compasses, instruments, DF and WT, Director of Finding, wireless technology. Wireless is opposed to radio and Morse. Meteorology, of course, that was a very big subject. It won a lot of people now problems with. Photography, that is from aircraft, with a big 5-inch negatives that they used to use. Recognition, that's the ability to fly over a thing like, nowadays, I think I've been told they fly over Portbury, and they get marked on it if they estimate the number of cars down there, or they get a bit further on, you can come back and tell the man whether it's a wooden bridge or a stone bridge or a steel bridge or reconnaissance, they call it. Signaling, well, that again, that is all sorts of signals that you use in the airport. Armaments, and then you have air exercise navigation, because you fly on this course. This is when you fly first in the RAF on Anson aircraft we flew. And you also do, as you're an air observer, you do an air exercise bombing.
Right.
And you've got to pass all those with more than 60%.
Mm. How tough did you find it?
I found it quite easy. And in fact, I got 80% overall, finally.
Yeah. But some people dropped out.
Oh, yes. You did lose. You lost quite... I would say you lost a third.
Really?
Mm. And of course, there were three ways they could drop out. They would be nice to them and say, well, you're not very good at plotting. Because the bombing was coming in now, and they were saying, but you don't do bad at bombing, you know, you're not 80% at bombing, it's just you're... So we'd like to be a bomb aimer. And of course, they became bomb aimers, and they wore a B badge. Mm. And then, of course, there were other people who couldn't hack the navigation, but they were most likely up to 22 words a minute in Morse. So they'd say, well, it'd be better for you not to become a signaler. Mm. And then there were the people, they were obviously very keen, but their educational, they weren't any good. And they would become air gunners. But the other 60% or so, 70% or so, you would carry on, and eventually you would pass out. And
how long did the AOS take?
It took from 16th of February 1942 to the 8th of June 1942. Mm. And that was the Air Observer's navigational course. And although we did a bit of bombing, you weren't... you it wasn't it was only a secondary sort of thing. I don't know. I suppose if you failed very badly, you would be, but you weren't there to learn to be a bomber. That you did on the next course you did after that, and you was by now you were an LAC, a leading aircraftman. There's no Lance Corporal, of course, in the Air Force. But some of us were made acting corporals. Mm-hmm. Now, this was usually station only. You wouldn't get paid, but you would get a corporal's tapes, and you would be allowed to eat in the corporal's side of the mess. Mm-hmm. It was not a very nice thing, and I was a corporal for a while. But as soon as you'd also left the station, you reverted to LAC. So it wasn't, I don't think it was even on your documents. You were just somebody that they could blame.
Did you have any duties as a corporal?
Not station duties, no. You were purely responsible for marching the men from A to B. And also, of course, one of the horrible things it did teach you, of course, you've got to be a bit of a snitch, you know. You've got to be prepared to go in and say, this bloke's kind of going out in night 8 and he's not coming back to 8 in the morning, you know. You've got to be... Which is why a lot of us didn't like to be corporals, because we felt we were doing their job and not getting paid for it, I think.
So when you'd done your navigator training in Canada, you came back to the UK, did you?
No. I then had to do what I call a bombing and gunnery school.
Right.
And I went, in fact, to number 6 bombing and gunnery school, which was on the lakes at in Canada, the big lake. Mm-hmm. Ontario, I should think. I remember right now. And there you had, mainly that was a practical course, because you'd done all the theory of bombing before. In a very short course, you flew not very, very long, and you fired guns. The guns were fired at drogues, and when you loaded your guns in the morning, you dipped they're in a chain. You rolled them up and you dipped them in some red goo or blue goo or green goo. And when you shot at this thing and you would shoot and another man would shoot, they would count the ones with the blue rings around in them. And
and what sort of guns were these?
These were the VGOs, Vickers Gas Operated, they were called. Mainly it was to give you experience of sitting in a turret. I never really knew why they bothered to train a navigator, because if you're navigating, a gunner's main job is looking out for aircraft, and you were there, you weren't... I suppose if you got into a battle... you no longer need to navigate, and you could pull the gunner out of his chair if he was dead and take over from him, I suppose. I don't know. But we flew in what they called the ferry battle, which had a turret. And we also bombed in the ferry battle. It was a bit more stable platform, I think, than the Anson. But then we were supposed to be coming back to England. And in fact, I finished that course in July 42. Oh, and then that was the time you went on parade and got your sergeant's tapes and your wing. Unless you were in the top 30 and you got you made an officer, a parole officer. For some unknown reason, I was academically in the top, but I never got my commission then. I never know why. Nobody to ask anyhow, was there? So I became a sergeant. And we went off to a place called Trenton to come back to England on the boat. And they said, no, you're no longer observers, no longer a thing, you've got to become a navigator now. So they sent us to what they called it, I don't know what it's called now, an air navigation school. And this was number 1 air navigation school in Canada. and it was a comparatively new school, and all they taught us was astro navigation.
So was this something you'd done before at all, or
we talked about it, and well, most of us would spend time outside our beds identifying stars, of course. We knew the principles of astro navigation.
Right, I'm going to stop you there. John Street, end of reel 2.